This podcast was brought to you in part by Dragon Shield. Use code PLAYTOWIN5 at the affiliate link down below for 5% off to help support the show.
This is the Play to Win podcast, where we talk about winning in CEDH. I noticed you already turned me down like you normally do right away. I am Cam.
And I'm Dylan, and I turn Cameron's volume down just a little bit every time. This week, we are talking about tournament CEDH. What tournament CEDH is. Before we even get started, what's our experience with tournament CEDH, Cameron?
That's a great question. Don't look at our records.
Mostly an observance is how I think of it. I don't even know if that's a word.
That is a word.
Yeah, we pay attention to a lot of tournaments. We don't play in a lot of tournaments. For as much as we play CDH, which we do play a metric ton of CDH, tournaments is just not one that we do. Most of the time, we got to use the weekends to like record stuff, and that's when tournaments are. So it's hard to like overlap that a lot of the time.
I have a little bit of a bias towards tournaments in paper as well too. So I tend to lean towards the availability of local tournaments that are near me that I will be able to physically get to that I can play in paper versus playing in an online tournament just for my own purposes, just because I like that experience of playing in person a little bit more.
I enjoy the in-person aspect of playing Magic. That's the part that I really like. We do record a lot of webcam Magic for the show, which is also great because we get to play Magic with people that we don't often get to play with, but in-person Magic is the shit.
In-person Magic is the shit. It's the gathering that we all like the most in Magic, so I don't want to exclude that portion of my tournament experience.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
having said that,
we're going to judge the tournament scene.
Yeah. Keep that grain of salt in mind.
Yeah.
Now we're going to talk about the tournament scene. We do play in some tournaments. We have tournaments at our local game store, Cloud City, which we have one coming up. Wow, this is a flawless right into it.
I also thought that the timing of this was kind of perfect. We just announced that our next Cloud City event is going to be August 24th and 25th. So if there's still space and if you would still like to sign up, you can go do that at a link that I will provide in the description below. And we'll also have a day two where you can fire off on-demand pods as well.
All the information will be below, proxy friendly, a whole bunch of other stuff. We'll talk about stuff now.
Exactly. So this is going to be the fifth one that we're doing there, because we had a 32-player tournament. We had two 64-player events.
And then one at Strauss.
Yeah, and then the last one at Strauss was a 96-player event. So this second one at Strauss is also going to be a 96-player event.
Number five.
That's awesome. So this is our fifth time that we're doing one of these. We both played in Punt City 1 and Punt City 2 as well. But unfortunately, we weren't able to make it to Punt City 3.
No.
But we do hope to get to other local events that are coming up too.
I would love to play more CDH tournaments, but like I said, we record on the weekend. It's just hard to find a weekend free that matches up with our schedule. Yeah.
So again, just to also preface this, the other reason why we're talking about this is because we did get a question from our patron Gecko21 that is very relevant to the CEDH tournament scene. So we will be including that as well too. But I think the first thing we should just get out of the way with talking about the tournament scene is talking about the decks that are the tournament scene. Like, what make up the tournament meta so that we know when we're talking about tournament CEDH, TEDH, what decks to expect, what people are expecting to play around, and what we're metagaming against, because these decks are the highest performing in TEDH.
Yeah, CEDH is huge. There's a ton of different decks that you can play. There's so many options. And although you can play all of those decks in TEDH, nothing's stopping you. Certain decks do rise to the top over and over again. You can't really argue with results when we've seen so many that these same decks just continue to outperform the rest. And there can only be 10 of the top 10 decks. And you know what I mean? Like, there's only so many options of the best of the best.
Exactly. So we're going to fire through the top 10 decks really quickly. So at the very bottom of the top 10 is Crown Tevish, which is actually seen 19 top 16s, according to EDH top 16. Right now, that's where I'm getting my information, that we're using.
We're using all the information from EDH top 16 from the last year, basically, from January.
For this year.
So 6 to 7 months. We're just over halfway through the year.
Exactly. Yeah. Another good reason why the timing is perfect. Yeah, so Crown Tevish has 19 top 16s, and its conversion rate is actually only 16%.
Not super high.
Which is not super high, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
But I think that is just what also happens when you have 118 entries and a lot of other decks aren't able to, like, they just don't have the same amount of entries as this one does.
Yeah, Tevish Crom is definitely like the, from what I understand, the mid-rangiest of the Grixis deck. There's other Grixis-ish decks. I mean, technically maybe Blue Farm is more of a mid-rangey Grixis deck, but pure Grixis,
yeah.
This one is the slower version more often than not. Still powerful deck, Grixis is always going to be good, but yeah, it doesn't seem like the actual conversion rate is really what you want. For me, I feel like the conversion rate, I want it to see at least over 20% before it's a deck that I really want to consider.
That I'm super interested, which is actually funny considering what some of these other rates are going to be when we come up on them too. Now, they're ranked in order of how many top 16s that they've had because we're going results-based. That's kind of what we're focusing on here. So that means that Atraxa Grand Unifier is actually next at 21 top 16s in 2024 so far with only a 15.91% conversion rate because there's been 132 entries. This deck has seen a lot of play because it was very good when it came out in 2023, but people now, because it's been such a mainstay in the top performing decks in the format, people know what to expect from it and are starting to metagame against it more.
Yeah, definitely. I just took this deck apart.
Oh, you officially did?
I officially took it apart. The deck is sweet, that's for sure. It's a good deck. I want my commanders to be more active in the beginning parts of the game. It feels so often that turn 1, 2, 3 are like the most crucial turns of CDH. That's obviously the case. And I want access to as many options as possible during those first few turns. Turn 2, Atraxas are possible. Turn 3, Atraxas are common enough. I want like 3 mana or less right now. I just want efficiency. With everything getting more and more mid-rangey, I want to be able to do my shit before those Rhystic Studies get too active. Once there's 3 or 4 Rhystic Studies, it becomes so difficult. But if I can do my shit before, when there's just maybe 1 Rhystic Study or something like that, that's what I'm looking for nowadays.
That's true. So you're trying to speed up a little bit more is what it sounds like. Yeah, you don't want personally the opportunity for other people to get so many engines down before you can win.
It seemed like so often that normally what Atraxa has to do is cast Atraxa, sculpt a perfect 7, pass a turn, and then win on your next turn. But so often I was casting Atraxa, keeping up even a Force of Will or something, and then still dying after the cast Atraxa. I just spend 7 mana to kind of not do anything.
Yeah, you can only get so many cards off Atraxa, and not every Atraxa is the dream Atraxa where you have 6, 7 cards in your hand after you resolve it. So
spending 7 mana to potentially like whiff is not good. Not saying that Atraxa is bad, it's still a great deck. I'm just off it for now.
Still a good deck, but maybe there is a reason why it only has a 15.91 conversion rate in 2024 so far. Now that means that the number 8 deck is Magda.
Nice.
This is awesome. 27 total top 16s this year, 90 entries. That's a 30% conversion rate on the dot.
That's crazy.
It's been performing stupid well. One of those conversions is the win that it got at our last tournament, which is also
That's super awesome. Cool. Yeah.
This is a reason for me to like kind of want to put Magda back together. I took her apart because the deck was leaning towards stacks, and I don't want to play a stacks deck. I'm not a good stacks player, but it seems like it's not necessarily a stacks deck in like what you should think of a stacks deck. Like when you think of stacks deck, you should be thinking of like Rule of Law kind of effects. This is like tempo stacks.
Yeah, since it can search its library of stuff, it kind of has the ability to stop whoever it needs to when it needs to. Magda's greatest strength is that it can just win on the stack. It can just activate and find these win conditions. We've seen it on our channel. It's so powerful. Yeah, I agree that I don't really want to be doing stack stuff either right now, but I feel like Magda's is like you're only playing a certain amount of very crucially important stacks pieces. It's not a full-blown stacks deck, right?
Exactly, yeah. Like I said, it's kind of like your tempo pieces. It's the way that you're interacting as opposed to having so many like counter spells that blue decks get to play. You are instead playing artifacts that you need to get rid of to still win the game, funnily enough, sometimes. Yeah. But this is a reason for me to kind of want to put the deck back together. I haven't played the deck since we got Roaming Throne, and I feel like that just...
Big ad.
Yeah, right? I feel like that just makes it so much easier to do what you want to do with this deck. So definitely high on my list of decks that I'm looking to put together now.
It's definitely a deck that does have weaknesses. Opposition Agent, Drana and Nvala, and any way to stop the searching of the libraries or even like artifact hate, like Collector Oof, it's not perfect against it. It actually can work around Collector Oof, but there are other things that can help. There are ways to beat this deck, but the interesting part about Magda is it will basically never go for a win until somebody else's win is like on the stacker. It has to, right? That's how I see it played.
Basically, yeah. If you can hold up and wait for someone else to be trying to win before you can.
That's the best part. Thassa's Oracle, everyone's like pass, pass, pass. In response to that Thassa's Oracle trigger, Magda's just gonna win.
Yeah, Magda is so much fun and definitely a deck that a lot of players still don't know how to play against if they don't have someone in their pod who was always on it.
That's my biggest reason for me wanting you to put it back together, because I for sure messed up how to play that deck the last time we played it. I think I probably could have found a different place to interact with, so if you play it, I can practice against it.
I take it apart once you figure it out again. Yeah. Is like my history with Magda, because now
once you figure it out, it's easy.
But yeah, exactly. But like I feel like I should just keep it together for when like you and I aren't in pods anymore.
Right,
at some
point. Maybe.
Because that is a strange strength of Magda, and again, you do lose that when you play against the same people all the time.
And you get to play so many unique cards. I think as Commander players, I think often we like playing a deck that has like a bunch of unique cards that no other deck can use, and Magda being only 2 mana, it turns all these dorks into Birds of Paradise so quickly.
Yeah, right? Like, you're building your own Land of War elves out of things that, like, you shouldn't be making them out of, which is so funny. But Kenrith the Return King is the number 7 deck then.
Which is a deck that you have played and found some success with.
I have, yeah. I got a ticket at top 16 this year. There's been 30 of them total for a total conversion rate of 20.13%.
Okay, so still better than our first two that we talked about, but not as good as Magda.
Certainly not as good as Magda. Not even close.
But more people play this deck and have done well with it.
There's 149 entries in here, so.
Why do you like this deck for Tournament Magic?
I like this deck because it can just do everything that you need it to do. Like, there's really no gaps in your strategy.
It's a catch-all.
It's a great catch-all, right? Like, I feel really good coming into every pod. It's the same reason why I liked Jund in Modern, was because I didn't feel like I had any bad matchups, and I don't feel like I have any good matchups, yeah. Right? Like, but I also feel like I have a good chance of winning every single game that I'm playing. So you play all of the best card advantage engines, so, like, if you can just find something early, you can just, like, make sure that you play correctly, and if you can play cleanly, you can do well. Also, because people don't know what you're doing either. Like, Kenrith has so many different options for what it can do. You could do Reanimator. You can lean into combo lines that, like, no one else is doing. Who the hell would have known that Atali's something that people play in Kenrith? But
that
I'm
is
really
the thing. That's crazy.
I'm really thinking about it because you can Eldritch Evolution into it, so it seems really good.
And you can reanimate it with Kenrith.
Right, yeah. It just seems like such a good piece. So I think just Kenrith having access to everything and being the value engine that you need to be able to draw through your deck, being able to be the outlet for Dockside. Like, it checks off literally every single box that we are looking for in a commander. So there's really an infinite reasons why I like Kenrith.
It's so funny hearing you talk about Kenrith. The 5-color deck that I have together is Cody, and it couldn't be more opposite from Kenrith in every way. You're like, one of the pros is they never know what Kenrith is going to do. I'm like, Cody, everyone knows what I'm going to do. Yeah. Everyone knows my thing. Everyone knows I'm activating the book and I'm casting Ad Nauseam. Like, for sure. And you're like, I have no bad matchups, but no good matchups. I'm like, if I see a table with 3 blue decks, I'm like, man, I'm fucked.
If I see a table
with no blue decks, I'm like, great, I have the buy. Wonderful. So, like, it's just so different compared to what Kenrith does. And it makes sense that the safe version is the one that does well. And we will not be seeing Cody on this list for sure.
No, we will definitely not. But yeah, Kenrith has definitely done real good this year with how many entries in this conversion rate. This is that 20% that we're looking for. So right on the money, Kenrith Return King.
Yeah.
Now, the next one's another 5-color deck. We got Najeel of the Blade Blossom here.
Still here. I love that Najeel is still here.
Still here, right? 33 total top 16s for a conversion rate of 22.92%. Almost 23% conversion rate for Najeel.
Better than Kenrith, worse than Magda.
Yes, better than Kenrith, worse than Magda. This is really just typical. This is exactly what really we should be thinking of with CEDH.
Yeah.
Najeel should always be up there. I'm a little surprised she's not in the top 5, I will say.
Najeel feels like the closest comparison for some reason to Infect to me in other formats when Infect is good, is that, like, if you forget about Infect, it'll accidentally just beat the shit out of you because you forgot to pay attention to it. Najeel feels like kind of the same way. Like, we'll forget because there's so many other commanders that get card advantage and all these cool things, but Najeel just wins, like, so easily from so many different positions. It's got so many one card win conditions, 5-color, all the colors, all the cards. Yeah, Najeel is just, it's still great.
And it can go so fast, right? All of the strengths that these fast decks have of being able to win before all of the engines come online is exactly what Najeel is able to do, while also being able to leverage engines herself and survive into the late game as well and, like, take out the problem player before being able to win the game then when there's only 2 survivors left.
Kind of interesting that, like, her whole strategy is making 1-1s, and we talk about Orcish Bowmaster all the fucking time, and yet still she's able to still prevail through that. I mean, she makes warriors at a pretty quick rate. If they have the Orcish Bowmaster early, that can definitely be a problem for Najeel. There are ways if you can just kill all Najeel's stuff. But the good part about Najeel is, like, the B plan is Consultation Thoracle. You know what I mean? Like, its B plan is still a really good, efficient line. They normally play Ad Nauseam. They just attack from so many angles. Same thing like Kenrith. Kenrith can attack from so many angles, so can Najeel.
And I think that the meme of, is this a Najeel card? Like, actually has a lot of weight here, because if it's getting so many tools so frequently, it's constantly getting upgrades.
Yeah.
So you're always going to have a better Najeel deck than you had for the last tournament.
Yeah, that's very true. It does, yeah. Every couple sets, it seems like there's another really good warrior that's under 3 mana that generates some type of advantage. They all all don't always stick around forever, but it's definitely gotten a couple new ones. I really like the
Samut.
Samut's great, of course. Yeah, Samut is incredible. Yeah, but I was thinking of the green-white cat that makes so people can't cast spells on your turn. That's a warrior.
Ooh, Kutsil.
Kutsil. I like Kutsil in the Gila. I've seen it a couple times. I'm pretty sure that's a warrior. Can you fact check me real quick?
Yeah, cat warrior.
Cat warrior, yeah. I really like that, especially because of the tutors that you get in Najila. There's a bunch of ways to find Kutsil. It can help with Najila's stuff. Big fan of this deck. Big fan of this card specifically.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the top five now. So coming in at number five is Tivit, Seller of Secrets, with 39 top 16s, with an embarrassingly low conversion rate of 18.48%.
mean, just a reminder, we hate Tivit here.
Yeah. So
no, we don't.
The real problem here is that this is another one of these decks that has been a mainstay of Tournament CEDH since Ian did very well with it, like, at this point, 2 years ago, right? So it's been around for so long that people expect it. People know that Draenith Magistrate's really good against it. People are starting to know that they have to interact with the Time Sieve stuff, and they know, well, if someone else dies, then the Tivit player can't go for the win with Time Sieve, so
people know how to play against the deck. They know how to beat the deck. And I think one thing that Tivit suffers from is that its win condition requires you to take turns, and in CEDH, if you go to turns, that's it. You can't take infinite turns as your win condition if you run out of time in the tournament. And although that probably doesn't come up a ton, it is a real thing that one of your main win conditions can't get there on the last turn.
I've gotten draws from that before. Yeah. So it's certainly something that you can leverage as opponents.
I mean, Tivit's still good, obviously. It's this high up. A lot of people are playing it. You definitely are going to want to expect it going into a tournament. Yeah. You don't have to metagame against it. I don't think metagaming against specific decks is ever really great unless you can find something broad.
I guess when I say metagame against it, I guess it just mean like they know how to interact with it better. So like they know how to leverage Besage you instead of just like wasting it on someone else's like
Ristic Study
or something.
Yeah, right.
Ristic Study is the perfect example.
It's great. It's good. It's wonderful. There's ways to beat it. We know how to beat it.
Ways
now.
To beat it. Yeah. 211 total entries for this year. And with only 39 top 16s, that's why it's weighed so low there. But I got to tell you, it's not more lopsided than Kin and Bonder Prodigy, which is our number four card right here. We have an impressive 49 top 16s.
Very
but
high.
It better have a lot of top 16s if 384 entries are going to be here. This conversion rate is actually the most embarrassing. 12.76 is what it came down to.
Yeah, so it seems that a lot of people are playing Kinnan. Ton of people are playing Kinnan. Not a ton of people are winning with Kinnan.
Kinnan right now in the meta is like zombies. And what I mean by zombies is not like the creature type zombies. I mean like if you were to go up against a horde of zombies, eventually they're going to take you over.
Yeah.
So if you go up against so many Kinnan decks, because Kinnan is also a great entry point into CEDH for a lot of players as well, you're just going to run into a lot of these Kinnans out there. So statistically, they have to be making up some number of top 16s then as well.
Do you think that's a reason that we should be off Kinnan a little bit more? I know Tyler will never drop Kinnan, and Tyler is an incredible Kinnan pilot. I don't think he should. But if like, is this a reason to, if you're playing Kinnan and you're not sure about this deck, take it apart? Or if you're the Kinnan player, you just keep on getting try to get better with the deck? Because I do feel like it's a deck that favors knowing how to play the deck more than most decks. If you know how to play Kinnan, if you know how to talk to the table in a polite enough way, but convince them to do what you want to do, this deck can be really great. But without the skills and the know-how of like how to survive with this deck, maybe its curve is a little strange. Maybe it's a little bit of a trickier deck than we think.
Maybe the other thing that I want to know is how many of the same people are top 16ing with this deck? Is it only them who's top 16ing with the deck? Because if it's only like 20 people that have made up the 49 top 16 slots that are here.
I think we can check that. If you click on the Kinnan, you can sort by the person's name.
It is hard to determine this. So if you sort it by standing, there are three people that have won tournaments in 2024 with Kinnan.
Only three.
Only three. But they're all different people that won tournaments with this deck.
One of them is Tyler?
One of them is Tyler, one of them is Ian, and one of them is Dorman, actually. So all very
good pilots.
Good pilots. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Whereas there are still 384 total entries, and most of them are not making top 16.
So maybe that means, and Kinnan players will love that I'm about to say this, but oftentimes Kinnan is viewed as the immediate threat. Kill Kinnan right away, make sure Kinnan doesn't survive. Maybe that's not the case. Maybe Kinnan doesn't need to be targeted all as much. It's not winning a ton of games. Maybe you should be focusing more of your stuff on the decks that we're going to talk about that have done better than this, or the Magdas, or the Timnacroms, or the stuff like that?
I don't know if that's just a blanket statement to make, but I think maybe it's just, it's a good time to be reevaluating what we think of Kinnan in the meta.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot more cards that hate on it, like Orcish Bowmaster is still very prevalent, and it's really the only one of these like super mana dork heavy decks that is worried about Bowmasters in this top 10 here.
We haven't, Kenrith plays green and Najeela plays green, but the others don't.
My Kenrith list is not afraid of Bowmasters at all.
Yeah, you took all the one toughness dorks out.
And a lot of other decks are doing that not. Although now,
Birds of Paradise?
Birds is not in my deck.
Really? Birds, nope. I thought was still good enough.
No, Birds was not good enough. I do have Deathrite Shaman in the deck. The only things that die to Bowmaster in my deck are Bowmaster, Esper Sentinel, and Lotho.
Fine, yeah. Lotho, I do feel like is questionable, but Lotho being able to make its own treasure right away, I feel like makes it, like, fine enough.
It's been good enough that it doesn't, like, by the time it does die to Bowmaster, it's already been way favorable for me.
Right, okay.
That being said, yeah, maybe it is time to reevaluate what we think about Kinnan, but we've spent way too long talking about Kinnan now. We're gonna...
As per usual,
yeah. So we're gonna talk about the deck that slowly ekes it out in terms of total top 16s, but absolutely crushes it in terms of conversion rate.
Okay.
Rograkh Sylas. Rog-Sai has now had 50 top 16s this year with 161 entries. Significantly fewer, but that's a 31% conversion rate.
Oh, wow. Very
that
high.
That is the highest conversion rate in the entirety of the top 10.
Rog-Sai has 31%.
Rog-Sai has 31%.
We kind of knew that.
We should have known
we
that.
We should have
yeah.
known that. Grixis is the best color combination in Rog-Sai's Bex Grixis deck.
So why wouldn't it be in the top three?
Right,
and it deserves to be a spot here. There's been an absurd amount of Rog-Sai naysay over the past year, and I don't know why. You know what I do? Because people are sick of losing into the deck because it's got a 31% conversion rate. It's doing absolutely incredible. It is much faster than everyone else's card advantage engines, so it can certainly win around all of what the slower mid-rangey metagame that we're seeing is trying to do.
Most of the CDH games that I play go like this. Turn one, setup, everyone puts out mana. Turn two, card advantage, everyone puts out card advantage. Turn three, people start trying to win. Rog-Sai, in my experience, can pretty comfortably present turn two wins kind of often. When everyone else has just established their advantage on turn two, you can go for a win before they have access to enough mana to truly stop you. I think that's where Rog-Sai gets its power. But it also has the ability to not only be fast, but like have a very high acceleration rate, meaning it can go from nothing. Even on turn six, it can go from nothing to a win very quickly. You can think the Rog-Sai player is out of the game. They have only a few lands in play, seven in hand. And then all of a sudden, ritual, 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 they get to a win out of nowhere. That's kind of the benefit of the speed, is that not only can you go for the turn two when it's appropriate to go for that turn two, but you can also kind of win out of nowhere later on as well.
Yeah, because the snowball potential is huge, right? Like if they just have Jeskha's Will after a ton of other players have expended ways to try to stop someone else from winning.
Yep.
Even if that's like one of only two cards in their hand, a lot of times that's all they need to just like go, oh wow, I found like two tutors from this and like a way to make a ton more mana off of my Rograkh. So absolutely nuts stuff this deck can do. It is totally deserving of its top three slot.
Yeah, and it's so funny that like really all it is a zero mana creature, and just like having access to a free zero mana creature is that good. You just get so much extra speed with the rituals, the culling rituals and whatnot, so much extra free counter magic that's turned on right away, Fierce Guardianship, Deflecting Swipe.
And even the new one, the duplication.
The duplication has got to be great in that deck. Like it's just an extra Deflecting Swap, more or less.
It's a spell copier.
Spell copier. Yes. So it's not a redirect, but
the original will still happen.
In terms of a counter war, it does the same thing. If they counterspell your thing, you copy their counterspell to copy their counterspell.
Yeah, it's dual caster mage without the bond.
Right. Yes. Okay. Either way, Rog-Sai is great. It's probably the deck that I should be playing instead of Cody, but I like Cody, so I'm going to still try to do that for now. But if I were to switch for a tournament, maybe I would think Rog-Sai. I'm not sure.
The next deck is the one that I want to know. Is this what you put together after Atraxa? Is it Sissei?
I did put together Sissei, yes.
All right, good, because it has 80 top 16s this year with a conversion rate of 27%.
Yeah, that was one of the main factors as to why I put Seisei together. The deck just seems like it's putting up results. It feels like Magda. It wins in a similar, not quite as on the stacky as Magda does, but just off of activations like Magda does. But having access to five colors, that's a huge benefit.
Yeah, not having to cast spells like Magda so that you're not feeding Ristic and Mystics while you're trying to go off is super powerful.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why having like extra channel cards like the turtle, the colossal sky turtle.
Oh yeah.
Just like having extra ways to not need to cast spells before you go for a win, it just feels really nice in Seisei. It utilizes a lot of cards really well, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And I'm excited that you're putting it together so that I can learn more about how to play against it, because I think this is another one that like people don't always know what you're going for. There's so many different lines. A lot of people will play the Planeswalker variations where you have Nicole Bolas, the God Pharaoh, and the Amanatu and Teferi's Oath.
Yep.
Oath of Teferi. All these names are in weird orders that they don't actually appear in. But they combo with like either the... Is it one? What's the is it one that Nate loves?
The is it one is
Saheeli. Saheeli Rai. And then what's and then there's other planeswalkers you can do this with too.
Yeah, with the Nicol Bolas line, you can kind of draw through your deck and exile everyone's stuff. And then you can win with kind of a variety of other things like the Saheeli that you've mentioned just now.
Why didn't I let you talk about that?
I don't know. It's okay. The I was like, I know all these words, but yeah, you go off. I also like it because it is a great Dockside Emile deck. Emile being a legendary is really nice. The Infinite Treasures are really helpful with your commander because you just activate through to find the win condition. I also like that it can, with Derevi and Gaia's Cradle and Emile, also create infinite mana. It's a very powerful deck, I think. Having the cheap mana cost of the commander as well as an activation win line that can get you a win anywhere kind of shows why it's so good.
Yeah, I always like saying if you don't know what commander deck you want to play, place to say, because you can play all of the commander decks in one right
yeah.
here. Yeah. But the best deck, and no one should be surprised by this here, is Timna Kralm, Blue Farm, whatever you want to call this commander pair. This has 155 top 16s with a total of 602 entries with a clean 25.75% conversion rate.
This deck just continues to show up. Everyone loves to play it. It's an easy deck to pick up. It's an easy deck to learn how to play very well with very quickly, I think. It's also a deck that, as a good player, you can gain even more advantage from playing the deck.
I think that's the key thing to say, because like there is still a learning curve to this deck.
Yeah.
A lot of times, players in tournaments will lose to their own Esper Sentinels, and they won't realize that, like...
Been there.
It's a forced draw, right? There's stuff that players will play into because they go, oh, well, I know it's a good deck. I'm just going to bring it to a tournament. And if they haven't practiced enough with it, they won't have come into some of those niche scenarios that veteran Blue Farm players have been into that are able to get themselves out of, right?
That makes sense.
So I think that this is a deck that is very sneakily skill-based, and you will do significantly better the more reps you have with this commander pair.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's got access to the most powerful cards, which means you have the most choices, right? Because if all your cards are good and you can choose any one of them, sometimes in the lower power decks, you're like, well, this is the spell that I can cast this turn, so that's what it is. Blue Farm can cast solid shit all the time, so with more choices comes more responsibility. I think that's what Spider-Man's uncle said.
He said something very similar to that, but... I think that line is copywritten, so we can't say it verbatim anyway.
Are you sure?
I don't think so.
Yeah, but Blue Farm is going to continue to be good. It gets all the good colors. It's going to get all the good cards, all the staples of CDH. Anytime we get a new staple, Blue Farm probably gets to play it.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So let's talk about, now that we know what the meta looks like, I have a couple of other subcategories here that we got to get into to kind of really... establish where we're at in TEDH and kind of get our opinions about them.
Okay, I'm into it, yeah.
Great. So the first thing I just want to say is we do have one honorable mention here that is a huge talking point in the format, which is Nadu Winged Wisdom. We should talk about where this is for the year.
We didn't mention Nadu in that top 10.
No, Nadu's not in the top 10, but Nadu, do you know where Nadu is on the list?
Mm-mm,
number 11.
Oh, really?
So it's very close behind. Very close behind.
Already, it's just been out very
briefly. Considering
replayed.
That it's only been around for a short amount of time, there's been a surprisingly large amount of show in tournaments for this deck already. And I think part of that is hype. Because it is very new and it is very powerful. I think that is going to draw a lot of players to just go, oh, I'm just bringing the new hotness to the tournament.
Yeah.
So that means that Nadu has had 53 tournament entries so far in the past month that it's been around, right? Nadu has top 16'd 18 times. That puts Nadu at the highest conversion rate out of all of the decks that we've talked about so far, which is 33.96, a virtual 34%.
Yeah, that tells a whole different story.
That tells a whole different story. Now, I'm taking a lot in from this information.
Smallish sample size.
And now,
right?
Maybe, as a Nadu player myself, maybe some of this is a little bit biased, but I want to keep a lot in mind for here that, yes, the hype that I already mentioned is playing into this because there's so many people that are going into these tournaments with it. They are doing very well. Now, is that also because the deck's super good, or is that also because nobody knows how to play around it? We've also seen that there's a lot of different versions of the deck. The versions that I played early on in its lifespan in CEDH on the channel has already changed, right? The versus the deck that Tim just played on the channel, right?
It's also important to remember things like Winota. Winota did really great in tournaments for a while.
Yes.
And we all figured out how to beat Winota. And then Winota never showed up again. That could be something that's happening now. It's hard to say. It's still early on. But that could be something that's happening. Once we figure out how to play around Nadu, maybe we can stop it.
Maybe it will turn into exactly what's happening with Kinnan then too, right? Because Nadu is also playing a lot of weak, frail creatures. So it's going to have a lot of the same issues that Kinnan's going to run into as well. It's still going to be very fragile, even though it does have a little bit more card advantage that you can get if it is targeted. But there's non-targeted ways that you can deal with it that people already know how to deal with.
That's my biggest issue that I've kind of said before, and it's not really an issue, but just a reason as to why Nadu is so good, is like in the process of you dealing with Nadu, you give the Nadu more resources a lot of the time, which makes it easier to recast the Nadu and keep on chugging along and doing stuff. I don't think we're in a spot where we're like,
ban Nadu.
I don't think we're close to that yet. We would need so much more information. For me, I want like 2 years of this card before we would ban it. You know what I mean? So I'm not looking to do that anytime soon, but it is a commander that at tournaments you will see. A lot of people are playing it and they're doing well with it. So you have to maybe not completely metagame against it, but if you're like, I could play Janith Magistrate. Do I want to play Magistrate? Yes. Those are the decisions that I think you want to lean into.
Yeah, I think so too. And that's that is an interesting aspect of TEDH, is that like, because you know what decks to expect, you'll know, oh wow, Atraxa, Tivit, like these are all very commander heavy cards that are very expensive commanders. Even Kenrith is on that list too. Seeing Nadu approach this list makes you go, oh, okay, that's a tipping point. I need Janith Magistrate. Like, that's just another reason to, you know, be thinking about what you should be putting into your deck.
Yeah, definitely. And I think Nadu's explosiveness is one that kind of just commands respect in the early turns of the game. If you have the option to expend your mana or play a Rhystic Study or play the Janith Magistrate, if there's a Nadu at the table and they haven't cast a Nadu yet, I'm leaning towards getting the Janith Magistrate out there. It's just you need to stop them early. Stopping them later becomes not easier, but more doable once everyone has mana and resources and counter magic. Stopping them early is kind of tricky because they can normally fight through one or two pieces of removal, but if you give them a plethora, it's going
to
be harder.
Yeah, that's true. It's fun and cool to have cards, but it's also great to still be in the game and still like not be losing.
Yeah.
Hello, this is Cam from a little bit more into the future than when we recorded this episode. If you notice, we had that little asterisk above all of the statistics that say these are the stats for the time of the recording, but I think after talking about Nadu not making the top 10, I think it's really funny that actually right now Nadu has pushed Crom Tevish out of the top 10 and is now sitting at spot number 9 with a 35.53% conversion rate with 26 total top 16s and 76 total entries into tournaments. So I don't know, maybe just also to keep this into account while you're taking in all the other things we said about Nadu and forming your own opinion on what you think of it in the format. All right, I'm done. Let's get back to the episode. So let's get into a couple other things I want to talk about here then too. We have a question from Gecko21. He wants to know, we've seen CEDH become more popular in the competitive scene with like SCG having 5K side events and even larger national tournaments, etc. I would even start to include like it being on Magic Online now at this point to be a subcategory here. But do you think that the growth and popularity of an in real life competitive stage is sustainable with the high cost of entry comparatively to regular EDH?
No. We have to do proxies. I don't think it can grow too large without the use of proxies. It's a similar thing to Vintage, where like Vintage is just capped by the expensive cards. There are proxy tournaments that you can do in Vintage that are more accessible, but the cards are just too expensive. Like most decks need a Mana Crypt and a Mox Diamond, and those are cards that are just out of reach for a lot of players, obviously, because they're insanely expensive. I think as long as we can allow proxies, the growth from CDH is like nearly exponential. I think it's one of the coolest ways to play Magic, especially these days. It's just gotten so popular. There's so many people that do it. But without proxies, it's just, there's not enough people that will be able to play it. You know what I mean? There's not enough people that can afford that.
That's kind of the problem. So the reality of the situation is that if Wizards is going to invest more in CEDH, the best thing for them to do if they want to do paper tournaments is to abolish the reserve list and reprint the CEDH staples so that that way they can continue to grow this side of the format, which clearly has only been growing in popularity and more traction more and more. And honestly, the more that like other casual groups decide that they want to start pushing into CEDH more, we're only going to see CEDH continue to grow. And
yeah,
it's, I think, going to be one of the more faster growing formats than anything else that Wizards is going to put out themselves.
I have an imaginary fix in my head. Can I run it by you? See if you think it's
rational. What do you think? What do you think?
What if Wizards says for tournaments, we will temporarily allow proxies for the reserve list? And by allow, I mean they will provide the tournament organizer with the proxies that the players will have to borrow and then give back to the tournament organizers at the end of the tournament. This way, no one can actually keep these proxies, and anyone who wants to use anything from the reserve list can just use one of the proxies that Wizards has authorized as just a temporary card. Is that something?
I kind of like that idea.
It's not collectible. No one can sell it because you're not allowed to take it. And if you try to sell it, that's like illegal. Wizards will come after you, yada, whatever. But if you're just borrowing a Wizards approved thing because the reserve list makes it impossible to play Tournament Magic, like, who does that hurt?
I would say they'd have to make them gold border. Like, yeah,
it would be very obvious that they were not
like
real.
You can't make it like super close to what the actual card would look like. But I would say if anyone should be making those cards, it should be Wizards. Because they're the people that have the power to make a Magic card feel like a Magic card. So they could make proxies that won't be distinguishable from the rest of the cards in your deck.
It becomes tournament official, and then Wizards gets to like invest in the community, which I feel like is like a cool thing that Wizards should do more of, is just like allow these tournaments to happen.
I think that's a great idea, because you definitely need to be able to proxy for this to happen. I would like to say too, the proxy tournaments aren't going anywhere, even though that SCG and events like that are non-proxy. Our Cloud City events are always going to be proxy-free.
Proxy-friendly.
Proxy-friendly. Free proxies.
Free to proxy.
Man, the verbiage just matters a ton. But yeah, so I don't think that any of those like grassroots proxy-friendly tournaments are going anywhere, but the competitive paper tournaments are definitely going to be stunted and have skewed metagames until Wizards comes in and does exactly what you said.
Yeah, I agree.
Here's a question that I have for you now. How do you feel about draws in tournaments?
I was just seeing some stuff about this. I was thinking, why don't we just get rid of the draw? If it's a draw, you everyone lose. I know for a fact there's a reason that we can't do that.
So the reason why I wouldn't be sad about the draw is because, you know, this thing went around on Twitter about this guy in Pioneer who won an event by only playing three matches. He won three matches, and for the rest of the event, his buddies scooped to him.
God, well, that's different. That's not allowed.
It is, because now this guy gets to go to whatever the next level is outside of the RCQ.
Yeah.
And he and all of the buddies that scooped to him can caravan to the tournament now.
Oh. Oh. Is that icky? Let me think about that. That feels icky-ish, right?
It doesn't feel good if you don't have a lot of friends who also play in this format and you're going to the event by yourself and you don't have 17 friends that are there who, if you just happen to get paired to, they're like, oh, hey, we all did this for me at the last event, so I already have my invite to the next thing.
Oh, yeah,
so now
smart.
We're specifically targeting it for you.
Yeah.
So if you know enough people and you can get enough people together, you can kind of force all of your friends to go and kind of manufacture who the best players are.
It won't
all
be perfect. You have to have so many friends, right?
Yeah,
some of the
so
tournaments
many
are
friends,
bigger.
But it happens, though.
But
I mean, this guy
happened.
Only had to go 3-0, and he did have to win the final match.
He had to
match,
go 3-0.
But the funniest part was he put Ban Amalia as his hashtag, as if this was a reason to say his deck was too powerful.
Oh, yeah. I guess it doesn't correlate exactly if a chunk of your wins were
no,
given
there
to you, right?
Yeah, there was a lot of just information that was just posted there in that tweet that just wasn't framed in the best way, I would say, but it definitely makes you go, like, is there a good reason to have draws in these? Because in CEDH...
how do you stop that? Because to me, that's, like, unsportsmanlike conduct. Like, losing on purpose is, like, you can get in trouble for doing that in sports if you lose on purpose, right?
There's imagine like, you your fan base, right? Could you imagine if, like, the Philadelphia Eagles purposefully...
threw a game because they were friends with the opponents? Like, they're like, we had it last time, you guys have it this
time. Yeah, oh, like, we're already locked in for the playoffs, I mean, and we want you to be locked in for the playoffs, so we'll take a knee?
It's different. Sports are different, obviously. But it's still competition, and I feel like you want the competition to be valid and to mean something and for the data to be real, and if your wins were given to you, that's not exactly as accurate.
See, the reason why people will go for these kind of situations is because draws still give you points in tournaments, or at least in the context of CEDH, right? Like, if you win in a CEDH tournament, that might be worth 4 or 5 points depending on what tournament you're doing, and then if you draw, that's still a point. So a lot of times, like, that's why players will win 2 games in a CEDH tournament and then try to draw the rest of the rounds because they'll go, oh, I only need 10 points to guarantee myself in the top 16.
I have a question. What is the downside if we just say instead of having a draw, you all lose? You get no points.
So here's
what's the downside.
Here's
there?
A downside.
Give
here's
it to
a
me.
Situation that Sam Black tweeted about recently that I think was super interesting. This is what Sam tweeted. Interesting first round today. At the start of the match, Sisse in seat 4 spends a lot of time complaining about getting pared down because he wanted to draw. At the end of Sisse's turn, seat 1 Korvold casts Calling the Weak. I slide him my Fierce Guardianship, and say it resolves. So we know that he's got this Fierce. He takes no further actions and untaps and plays Korvold. Timnathrasios plays Thrasios Psychic Frog to join Esper Sentinel and their Smothering Tithe. Sam fetches for a soft opposition agent check, and then cast a Neoform that he's pretty sure will win because he's got the Fierce Guardian backup, unless the Timna player has an opposition agent. The Timna player does, so Sam passes, and then Sisse plays something irrelevant and passes. Korvold then casts Calling Rit. He shows Force and says at this point he can decide who wins. If he counters this, none of us are beating the Timna engine, and if he lets it resolve, Korvold's winning on the spot. Sam wants to draw, and if either of them refuse, I'm giving the win to the other person. So the table decides to draw, and now we all get the whole table gets a point.
I actually responded to this. Someone asked me my opinion on the play to win. Do you have the tweet up?
So this is what the play to win Twitter account said then, was the only clarifying question is how did we know that Korvold was going to win? NSEP Calling the Weak is signifying that there's an ad nauseum technically here, I guess. Was it certain that Korvold had ad nauseum? Because after Calling Ritual, Timna would be left with Smothering Tithe and Opposition Agent. If I'm the Timna player, I would want to wait to see if Korvold could actually present a win. Ritual is great, but Korvold into Smothering Tithe and Opposition Agent is a spot I'm willing to risk unless I know there's already a payoff. Unless there's more info I'm missing, if I'm the Timna player, I don't take the draw. Hard to say. Let me know if I miss something.
So basically what Sam is saying is that Sam has the interaction to stop this potential win from Korvold. We assume that Korvold probably has ad nauseum and then can, with all of this mana, probably cast an ad nauseum and win the game after that. Sam can counter this ritual so that doesn't happen. But if he does, he's afraid that he's just going to lose to Timna Thrasios with the advantage smothering tithe. There's just no way he feels he doesn't have a comeback from that. So he says, instead, I'll offer the draw. A draw is better than a loss. If everyone wants to draw, I'll do that. Otherwise, I'm going to give the game to the other player if you don't accept my draw. So it's almost like they like hold him prisoner, sort of just like, you must do this or I'm going to king make the person. Whether or not that I feel that that's like right or not, I'm not really sure. I don't have a super strong opinion on it. I think it's smart. I think it's like a smart decision if you truly feel that you're screwed either way, to see if your players will accept a draw. I think that's clever. It is a little hostagey, but like that's part of the game. Like that's part of politics in CDH. I feel like it's like within the lines, but you're in a situation where you king make either way. That's just the nature of CDH. That's going to happen. It's impossible to avoid it 100% of the time.
That's the thing. So it's in your best interest, right? And if I'm in Sam's seat, it's in my best interest to still try to get as many points out of this table as I can. And if that means that I have to force the table into a draw, I kind of have to do everything that I can to get myself into a draw. And he's really lucky here that like the Sisse player was already wanting to draw coming into this pod.
Right.
He was super able to leverage these other two players into wanting the same thing for themselves, because either way, they weren't going to get what they wanted. So it ended up being best for everyone to just get 1 point.
Right.
And if you take that situation out, right, if you say that you get 0 points for a draw, how does that change it if you're in Sam's position?
And if you're in Sam's position, you counter
the ritual,
hope that the Timna Thrasios player draws poorly or makes a mistake or something. It's low likelihood that you'll win that game, but there's still a chance if you don't lose the game right now. Like, it's, if you can choose to lose right now or lose in a turn, I'm going to try to lose in a turn because a lot happens in a turn. You know what I mean?
Yeah, if I have a Rhystic Study out, there's more spells that are going to get cast for someone else to win. So,
and if I'm in Sam's position, I'm doing that either way. I'm stopping the Korvold and hoping that I don't die to Timna Thrasios. That's what I'm doing. Like, trying to not die now and then hope that something changes in the next turn, to me, is just better. Like, what's the other option? Just like, oh, say, yeah, win now. Like,
oh, yeah.
That's a 0% win
if
rate.
If both of his opponents said, no, screw that, we're just going to keep playing the game, then I feel like that's kind of what he has to do, is he has to stop Korvold from winning so that he can try to make sure that this engine from Timna Thrasios doesn't actually win the game. Because it's not a guaranteed win. It's just an opposition agent, a Timna, a Thrasios, and a Smothering Tide. So it is a lot of advantage, but like, that's not a counterspell or a Thassa's Oracle right. combo. So
yeah,
I think, I don't know. I think all this being said, I would really not be sad if draws started being worth 0 points.
Yeah.
And points are only awarded to those who win.
So what did I miss? What is the bad part if we say no draws? Do you know what it is? Like, if we get rid of draws entirely, what is the negative of that?
Then there are going to be scenarios where you could king make. I guess there technically could be scenarios
here. Why would you want
to
king make, though? Because there's more of an opportunity to king make when you could potentially get a point for a draw. If your only option is win or lose, there's no reason to king make at all. There's
exactly. You just kind of force everyone to play all of their games and play all of their games to the best ability.
Yeah. So what is the negative, though? Because there's got to be one. There's got to be a reason why we do the draws.
Oh, no. That's the twist, is that there is no negative.
No, we probably just don't know what it is. Is there a points situation? Can you go to Ken's Twitter real quick? Ken tweeted something recently about a tournament that somewhere else was doing very differently with a crazy point system.
What's funny is that that's actually the next thing that's on my list.
Let's just talk about that.
Is Ken's situation?
Because we'll find the answer. Because I think in that thread, someone does mention the reason why no draws is bad. I just can't remember what it is.
So this was a tournament in Japan that had a completely separate point system here, where each player starts with 1,000 points. The winner of a game takes 7% of each other player's points. No points for draws, and in the case of a draw, every player loses, is what happens. Game ends on stack resolution once the 60-minute round is up. In top 16...
Why the fuck the 7%?
Why?
I don't understand that. Someone in math has got to know the reason. That's got to make a lot of sense. I don't know why they get 7% of the point. I don't get that.
So 7% of 1,000 is 70. So 1,000 divided by 70 is 14.28571428.
No, that can't be right. You don't get that many points. You get 70 points for a win. You get, what is it?
You get 70 points.
Yeah, you get 70 points for a win.
So, yeah, so then if you lose, then you have 930 points. The winner takes 7% of each other's player's points. So you walk away with 200. 110 points.
There's three other players.
Because there's three other players giving you 70 points.
Okay. I think we got there.
In the top 16, Swiss rank 1 is matched with rank 5, 9, 13, etc. The highest Swiss placing chooses whether to go first. In case of a draw in top 16 and top 4, the person with the highest Swiss is the winner. This means every game matters all day.
Okay, that's risky business. But I think I kind of like that. I like every game mattering all day. I like that.
King making can still happen, of course, but there's basically no reason to do so intentionally because, again, every game is going to matter.
Yeah, that's how I feel like that makes the most sense.
So overall, each player is being encouraged to win as many matches as possible all day.
That makes sense. Okay, I like that.
There's a downside to immediate loss at 60 minutes... and the round ends on the stack. There's some downside to that. I can get that, but we don't necessarily need to do that. Is the downside that
like you can take extra time to like? What's the downside in that though?
Well, that's the shortest amount of time I've ever seen in a CEDH tournament.
Yeah, normally it's like finish the turn, not finish the stack.
Normally it's finish the turn, and I much prefer the finish the turn situation.
I think it's like a finish the stack kind of makes more sense because, like, to me, finish the turn means like. If you're playing, I don't know why I'm relating to sports again. It's not a sports thing, but the clock should stop if the ball's on the way. You don't get to like have another one final play after the clock is over. Play's over.
You know, it makes sense that if you're not giving points for draws, why? What's the point of finishing out the turn?
Because then you have new information of like what the game is after that's been called. Like if you're the active player, you have information of like now the turn.
Well, no,
because
you're getting a loss anyway, so it's not like you even have the chance to win.
Right.
So like I think of it more like NASCAR, right? Like if the clock stops and you didn't get to the finish line, NASCAR, that's not what NASCAR is, but still, like, if the clock stops and you didn't get to the finish line, you shouldn't have the chance to get to the finish line.
It's also like in NASCAR that, like, other people can get in your way. CDH is like a race. It's not like a back and forth. Like, other people will slow you down, but beep at them. You know, it's NASCAR.
Yeah.
Say, I'm sorry, can you make a play? Like after it's been, you know, if it's been 60 seconds, say, you can politely say like, hey, can you make a play? We got to keep it moving.
And you know what? It kind of also disincentivizes a lot of politicking too. A lot of the bullshit politicking that goes on in CEDH games where people are just like trying to get other people to target other stuff.
Don't listen to people when they're politicking you. I have said this before. Rather, you can listen, but you don't have to act. You can hear what they're saying, but you don't have to do what they're saying. They're trying to win the game. They do not have your best interest in mind.
So here, the reason against it. This system is disliked by players who actually use it, is the argument against it. Players with a 1-3 record will place higher and eke out players who are 2-2.
Wow, why? Is that real? No, 2-2, you only get points for winning. How would that make sense?
If you're only getting points for winning... How does that math make sense?
Oh, because of like your matchups? Like if you're 2-2, but you've gotten paired with people who have also already lost, like if you get the pair down, it's really bad? My brain's not big enough for this.
Random matching and percentage gain means if you match into lower pointers, you get less for winning. And some dude
because
beating
you take
three,
70%, not a certain amount.
Right, because you're taking 7% of their points.
Yeah.
See, the way that I said it was you take 70 points of their 1,000.
But that's only true the first time.
Right, because 7% of...
930?
Wow, look at me having to Google what 7% of...
You're
so for your second win, this isn't right though either. In round two, if you're paired against everyone else who won,
but if
you're paired against people that have 1,204.
Right. The issue is if you get the pair down. If there's an uneven number of players and you have to play with people who have lost, you get a lower amount of points after
there's
that.
There's still more points that you're getting for winning.
It is still
I don't
more points,
see a
yeah.
scenario where someone who's 1-3 makes top 16 over someone who's 2-2.
That's what this person is saying. Maybe they're wrong. I don't know. Or maybe we just don't understand math.
Maybe I just don't understand math. The real answer is here is that someone else just said, can we do this instead? And it's just a picture of the star chip holder from Yu-Gi-Oh! And that's really what it should be. We should just be using star chips.
What if we don't do the percentage thing? And what if we just do points and you only get points if you win?
Hello, it's me again, coming at you in post. The other argument against removing draws and only awarding points to game winners is that it would essentially make buys be completely busted, and just giving someone 5 points for free or 4 points for free on a win is just a little bit too good when you're not giving other players the ability to at least kind of make up for the players that get buys by giving them the ability to get extra points for draws. It would apparently also really mess up tiebreakers too, which I can understand. If you don't have like those extra records, you're going to have a lot of other people with the same record. That's not to say that this is not a system to not try out, right? Like, just because it is this way now doesn't mean that it's not worth testing something out that seems like it could be interesting and maybe could fix some of the problems that exist in current tournament CEDH. I'm not saying that these should be permanent installations to the new tournament culture, but maybe it's just worth testing out. We can always go back to the other system. It's not like we have to scrap that entirely. I just don't think that saying, oh, just because draws have existed in tournament Magic forever means that they should exist, right? That doesn't mean that things can't be improved upon. Just because it always has been doesn't mean that it's the best way moving forward. So I don't know. I'm sure that there's people out there that know a little bit more about this than me. This is just kind of what I feel as someone who plays in tournaments and is trying to leverage the rules in such a way that it will allow me to get as many points as possible. Because like we said, I will continue to look for draws if it will help me get into a top 16 or top 10 scenario, which I also hear is another tournament structure that is really good, doing top 10s instead of top 16s. So either way, let's get back to the show. Our current tournament structure that we do with the play-to-win systems, we do 4 points at the Cloud City events for wins and 1 points for draws. We kind of do points for draws because that's kind of what the overarching community is doing right now. But I'll be honest, I wouldn't be sad if the overarching community decided that, hey, draws suck, playing for draws suck. We should just be only giving points to people who win games. If you don't win the game, you don't get points.
Play to win, not play to draw.
Play to win, not play to draw. Until that system's in play, though, I will be looking for draws when I can, because play to win the tournament is the long title of the podcast.
Right. For now, it's better to just sometimes trying to draw right now is better because it'll ensure a winning of the tournament later.
Exactly, yeah.
Thanks so much for watching or listening. If you'd like to support us directly, you can do so on Patreon, like our $100 patrons.
Very Khan, Old and Grumpy, Odd Set Orion, Gecko 21, Caleb Ritchie, Zach Hartley, Kajo Alex, Sean in the Ice, Mark Civilo, SoCal Acura, Stormageddon, Luke Cook, Demon of Rosgrease, Peter Stewart, Cornell Wild, Uncle Butts, Nick Foles, Godo 9, Kwaja A. Hamid, Lauren Connell, and Baby G Bus.
If you'd like to pick up any of our merch, you can do that at playtowinmtg.com, like our new playmats. We have new playmats. They were designed by Gold Sabretooth, and they're awesome. You can buy them down below.
Huge shout out to Dragon Shield for supporting the show. Use our affiliate link and code PlayToWin5 for 5% off your order.
Do I say something else?
Something about
TikTok, Twitter, and Instagram. Find it.
Thanks so much for watching.
See you next time. Or listening.
Mystic Muffin Man, Nick Saxby, Jacob Bauer, Reactive, Tyler Watson, Brian Barrington, Zachary Coulson, Tyler H, X Tyler the Tree X, Mallcraft, Driving Crooner, Jabaha, Mace the Ace, Dalton Poteet, Hobo Ghost, Justin, Man Solo, Jacob Depp, Jan Wildfang, Thomas Bueno, and David Nelson.
Do this, like, I think, yeah, when you moved it just now, there was like a strand. I think you're good now.
Oh, thank you. Oh, I appreciate you.
Check, my face is still good.
Beautiful face, you.